As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
To get you set up for the market action this morning, here we go. Futures negative 142 on a Dow, negative 13 points on the S&P 500. It is risk off almost across the board. I talked about that bid going into the Japanese yen. We have a 107 handle on dollar yen. We dropped to 107 spot 64, down by one full percentage point almost. And to round things out in the Treasury market for you, yields creeping high yesterday, this time yesterday, now lower by about 3 basis points to 2.83%. And for the VIX watchers out there, Tom Keene being one of them, we bleed higher, back to a 27 handle on the VIX. I'm really pleased to say that joining us now is Harm Bandholz, of course, the UniCredit chief US economist, on not just the year ahead, but on 2019 as well. Harm, do we need to start thinking about 2019 already?
Sure. It looks like 2018 is shaping up to be a pretty good year for the global economy, for the US economy, not least to this huge fiscal deficit. But then you talk about next year. I think what the fiscal stimulus is doing is bringing some growth forward. Plus, next year the recovery will be one of the longest on record, and we are worried that growth starts to slow down next year, and we may actually downturn in 2020, which makes not least yesterday's budget forecast by the president, something that looks way too rosy.
Is the good news becoming bad news? Your colleague over in Europe, Erik Nielsen, wrote the following over the weekend. What if the conclusion of the effects of the tax cuts is wrong? What if markets' attention has shifted to see the tax bill as a big piece of seriously irresponsible policy with the key effect being higher yields? It's an important question to ask. Are we seeing a shift in the interpretation, the market bias towards what we're seeing in the United States?
That was a bit the impression that we had over the last several, well, let's call it weeks. When better numbers, both on the inflation and economic front, I mean better meaning higher, yeah, numbers on the inflation side, were interpreted by the market that the Fed may actually hike more, and that at some point started to scare market participants. So yeah, you're right. If we also talking about tomorrow's CPI print, I would think a higher number would be worse for the markets than a weaker number.
Herm Bandholz with us with UniCredit. Good morning, everyone. I need to rip up the script, folks. This is so profoundly important that we've got to do it. We just heard the gentleman from England say Adidas. The gentleman from America says Adidas. We wouldn't know. What do you say in your Germany? Is it really Adidas or do you say Adidas?
No, it's Adidas.
And are you offended that I say Adidas?
No, I got used to it here.
You're the only one that cares about this, Tom.
No. This is like, forever, folks. What we do in surveillance is whichever fractured language I want to do when I say Sheffield or, other, yeah, unpronounceables in England, I fracture
Leicester.
It. And Leicester, yes, very good. And John Farrell, Adidas, that was very good.
Okay, thank you.
That's an import into the United States. Adidas is coming here. Tell us about the import dynamic of Adidas shoes and BMWs as well.
Well, I think BMW is, first of all, the biggest car exporter for the U.S. as well. We must not forget that.
So thank you. Did not know that.
So with all the bashing about all these foreign companies, we must not forget
it's, that. Its biggest plant is on the East Coast somewhere,
there
isn't it?
Spartanburg.
There you go. All the X models, I think all of them are produced here. And, well, they are doing pretty well.
You nail it, as you do, Harm. You're famous for this. You nail it with facts that shock, like BMW is our biggest exporter.
We try to convey the message that facts still matter. So yeah, it's important. And we can, you know, as economists, we just can't help looking at these numbers and some from time to time emphasize them. But to your question, the U.S. problem, as we know, is a huge trade deficit, current account deficit. And if you look at the real trade deficit without petroleum goods, we have just hit a new record high in terms of deficit. So the situation has never been as bad as it is right now. And that. Yeah. I mean, that has in part to do with import dynamics, because we have this fiscal stimulus, which supports the domestic economy, domestic demand, and part of that additional domestic demand is satisfied by increased imports. At the same time, the global economy is also doing very well, but the America's real problem is that it's not exporting, that it's not producing the stuff that the rest of the world really wants. So in other words, its import elasticity is much bigger than its export elasticity. So
with that in mind, Harm, to what extent does the weaker dollar of the last 12 months plus rebalance the trade deficit, if at all?
Yeah, it helps at the margin, there's no doubt about it. But I think the impact is relatively small. I mean, we must not forget the US has had large current account deficits as well when euro dollar was at 155. You know? So that shows us that there's much more to it, to the issue, than just the currency. So the currency is always seen as the easy fix.
Yeah.
But it doesn't fix it. You know, it helps to mitigate the impact. It makes it look a little bit better maybe. But overall, there are underlying problems that take much longer to fix. And that's why I think politicians always try sometimes try the easy way out.
There are two deficits to speak of. And the trade deficit is not the one on everyone's mind right now. The deficit on everyone's mind now is the budget deficit. Why all of a sudden has the budget deficit become such an issue for so many people, Harm?
because what we are seeing right now is I would say, is probably the most reckless deficit that the U.S. economy really has had. It's not the highest, but I mean, there were periods where we had higher deficits, where we were also facing big crises. Right now, the unemployment rate is at 4%. We are at or below full employment or very close to whatever. And that is the time where you actually should start repay some of your debt. Right. And what the U.S. is doing right now, we are not only not repaying that, but we are blowing up the deficit.
Yeah.
And what makes things worse, it is relatively easy to forecast demographics. That's one of the real easy long-term forecasts. And we know that demographics are against us, are against the deficit because the baby boomers are retiring. So if you look at the CBO's long-term forecast, it shows already without all this stimulus that we had, federal debt to GDP ratio almost doubling over the next 30 years. So this is the time to prepare for that, but that is coming, but we are doing the opposite.
Is it okay, John Farrell, if I do a chart out to Bloomberg Radio before anyone else sees it? I'm doing that right now.
I don't
now
know why you asked for my permission when you've basically done it already.
It's because you say Adidas. It's a real non-petroleum trade. Have I ever looked at a real non-petroleum trade deficit? No. Hard bondles, I'm sorry, it borders on a jump condition. Why is our real non-petroleum trade deficit jumping to a worser statistic?
I know the chart. So the latest jump looks a little bit suspicious. There's some volatility, but the underlying trend is very obvious, right?
Yes,
if you have
question.
It in front of you, look at it. So it was very high during the housing boom, the deficit, then it narrowed because of the crisis. And when the recession was over in the middle of 2009, it started to widen again. And it looks like there is no end to it. Right? And again, forget about the monthly volatility. You just put a 6 months moving average or what through it, and there's a pretty linear downward trend.
I'm Ben Holtz, UniCredit Chief US Economist. Really appreciate you catching up with us. And
without question, the most important interview of the day. Stanley Colander has helped us so much untangling the fiscal dynamics of Washington and the nation. Right now, we get perspective. He, on Twitter, at The Budget Guy, he writes for Forbes magazine, Corvus Group as well. Stan, I want you to sum how CBO will deal with the tax cuts, the congressional budget that was passed and signed by the president, and the Trump budget yesterday. How does an institution that we all rely on, the Congressional Budget Office, how do they synthesize those three events?
It's actually pretty simple, Tom. First of all, they're going to reject the president's notion that this pays for it, that the tax cut pays for itself. That's pretty much common wisdom in everywhere but the White House these days. So they're going to talk about the tax cut as a substantial contributor to the deficit and debt. Second, they're going to add $400 to $600 billion in additional spending and in additional debt and deficit because of the spending bill that was passed and agreed to last Friday. And they're going to reject all the president's proposed cuts because they're not likely to happen. So what they're going to do is, while the White House is saying the deficit will fall below $1 trillion next year, CBO is probably going to get there to about $1.4 trillion and project it
really?
Going up further. Oh, yeah.
There are, now this is really important, folks, because we're working with 1.1, 1.2. You're already out at 1.4. Do I understand that correctly?
You understand that absolutely correctly, especially when you take the president's overly optimistic economic forecast and substitute something that's more realistic. So you're at $1.4 trillion, and you know what, Tom? I know you and I have talked about this for weeks or months or years, but I'm not sure that's going to have the big impact on politics.
That's right where I want to go. Would you explain the why of this? Whether anybody's a liberal, a Democrat, they say Adidas or Adidas. Would you explain to me the why we've lost any sense of frugality in our political Washington?
This is a Nixon goes to China situation to a certain extent. You had Trump, who was promising the world to everybody that I can spend more, I can tax less, and I can balance the budget. Saying it doesn't make any difference, and besides, it's only temporary. If the Democrats go after the deficit, they will end up maybe having to be responsible for it and being hoisted on their own petard. And then you've got groups like the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget that have lost this debate and have no impact whatsoever. So to a certain extent, Tom, this is everybody saying, I want what I want when I want it, and
yeah,
if something bad happens, I will take care of it later.
Stan, certainly there's some politics at play here, a whole lot of politics. But something I want to ask you about, Stan, is what's changed? Because for years, a lot of people said, take advantage of low interest rates, stop worrying about the deficit. The deficit doesn't matter. We have a party in power that's basically said just that. But now, all of a sudden, a lot of concern. Why?
Well, look, Jonathan, I'm going to disagree with your premise a little bit. I don't think there's a lot of concern. If there was, the tax bill wouldn't have been enacted to the extent that it was, and the spending bill that they just went through
wouldn't
have been
enacted. Well, let me start again, Stan. The concern not within the Republican Party, the concern outside of the Republican Party. I read op-ed after op-ed through the weekend about how it was dangerous what they were doing for the U.S. economy, and ultimately the deficit was going to get out of control. These concerns not coming from within the Republican Party, coming from outside the Republican Party, when those concerns did not exist several years ago.
Well, all right. First of all, remember the uber conservatives, the Freedom Caucus, hated this spending bill, not the tax bill, but the spending bill, and criticized it heavily because of what it would do to the debt and deficit. So there is some internal Republican dissension about this. But to a certain extent, this is just pure politics. This is the party out of power criticizing the party in power. I'm not sure that the concern doesn't exist. It's just a little taking a back seat. Trust me, when interest rates start to rise, the same people who aren't saying anything bad about the debt and deficit increases will be the ones pointing the finger at the politicians, saying, you should have told us, you should have done something about it, you should have prevented this.
Well, Stan, help me take away the politics, drain the politics out of it. I don't want to politicize the deficit anymore. I want to talk about the economics of it. Why should we be concerned about 5% of GDP?
Well, first of all, it's coming. It's not just 5% of GDP. It's adding all that additional fuel on top of an economy that's already pretty much heavily stoked. I'm not sure, from a Keynesian point of view, you would recommend that this type of additional stimulus be done at this particular time.
Yeah.
And second, it really is going to limit. I'm looking a little bit longer term from economic and policy point of view. It's really going to limit the ability of the United States to respond to any new needs, whether it's a forest fire or a tornado or a nuclear holocaust type situation. or even an economic downturn, unless there's a stomach, a willingness to right. accept deficits in the $2 to $3 trillion range.
John brings up an important point, Stan, which we got to walk through right now, which is this tip point of 5% GDP. I don't buy it for a minute. My study of this and listening to guys like you for the years is 3% GDP is in the realm of frugal, normal, whatever. So we go from 3 to 5, which is, I believe, a 50 or 60% increase in deficit to GDP. Isn't 5 a pretty moldy number?
Yeah, no, I think so, Tom. And part of the new normal is what you were just saying. You know, because I know you commented on it, I wrote a column in Forbes that said the new normal is exactly what you're saying, which is, first of all, tolerance for higher deficits annually.
Yeah, but the markets won't, quote unquote, have tolerance, will they?
Well, right now we're seeing a little bit of gyration, and we're blaming it without any real proof about higher interest rates. It remains to be seen whether the bond market vigilantes are going to be coming back in force. These are the folks who forced Bill Clinton to revise his budget plans because with higher interest rates. But that is the political statistic. That's the one that will cross the economic and political barrier.
I know John wants to dive in here with wisdom, but what happens if Pharaoh's wrong and we get to 6% deficit to GDP? What's the difference between 5, the new normal, and 6?
Look, I got to tell you, since we've never really been here before, that is, in good economic times, getting to that level, I'm not sure that we know the answer definitively. But at some point, whether it's 6 or 6.5 or 5.25, at some point the markets are going to respond and respond negatively to what's going on. At some point, foreign investors are going to say, enough. I've had enough U.S. debt. I can't be sure you're ever going to pay it back at 100% on the dollar.
I want to be clear here. It's not about the concern of, say, 5 or 6. It's the direction of travel, Tom. And I think that ultimately should be the concern. There was a budget deficit to GDP in the UK of 5% just a couple of years ago. But the reason the market would give the UK the benefit of the doubt was, one, the Bank of England still had a big presence, and two, there was an effort to close that gap. I think, to Stan's point, the real concern, get rid of all the political drama, all the hysteria around this deficit of $1 trillion. The real concern is not now, not potentially next year, but the next downturn, when the fiscal options are exhausted at a time that the monetary policy options have been exhausted as well. Stan, is that way you're thinking as well? It's not in the here and now. It's the direction of travel, and the ultimate destination could be messy and exacerbated by the next downturn.
No, exactly right. In fact, Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, said yesterday or the day before that there was likely to be a sugar high with the economy short term. But remember, politicians in the United States only think short term. They're only thinking until the next election. And at some point, it's going to be someone's problem, but maybe not the current office holders, to deal with the next downturn of some kind. And our options, like you just said, are exactly limited. I want to expand that one more way. Well, what do you tell millennials who are going to end up having to pay for this? What do you tell them about the government's ability to deal with their problems 10 or 15 years down the road?
You're spot on, Stan. And Tom, this is a big issue. It's the biggest intergenerational wealth transfer in history that we're witnessing, not just in the United States of America, but across Europe and within the United Kingdom as well. And at some point, someone's going to pick up the bill, and the one that's got to pick up the bill will not have reaped the rewards of the last decade or so, Tom.
Well, it'll be interesting. Stan Collender, thank you so much. The budget guy with Corvus MSL Group as well.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Abby Joseph Cohen of Goldman Sachs wants to speak about the deficit, a number of other things she sees in the greater American economy, but we must start with these markets. Abby Joseph Cohen is Goldman Sachs Advisory Director, Senior Investment Strategist. Abby, I want to get the gossip out of the way. I have vetted this, and I know with your attachment to the Brookings Institution, you're familiar with Mr. Bernanke, and now Chair Yellen goes over there as well. I would think Jay Powell could get you to come down to be vice chairman of the Fed by just giving you the right seats over Ovechkin's shoulders for the Washington Capitals on a power play. I mean, would you think about being vice chairman of the Federal Reserve System?
I think it's fair to say, Tom, that you and I are not making those decisions. But thank you for suggesting it. When it comes to the Washington Capitals, though, why don't we talk about the Olympics instead?
It's a difficult year, to say the least. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we're seeing phenomenal figure skating. The women in particular are just absolutely extraordinary. They're artists, they're athletes. And when it comes to the Capitals, there were four figure skating coaches who recently watched the Caps play, and they said only one, and that's the center, Evgeny Kuznetsov, might make a good figure skater. And the rest of them just didn't have very good technique.
And their a window into Abby Joseph Cohen. I think your combination of financial acumen and economics would put you on the list with Dr. O'Laren. John Farrell, who else is on the list for vice chairman?
Rich Clarida,
and others as well.
San Francisco Fed President Mr. Williams up there as well. They're your top three, Tom.
Abby, let us address the markets. They were clearly over exuberant, if you will, and down we go. Have you changed your long tone on owning equities at this time?
Well, let's begin with fundamentals, which is where we always begin. How is the economy doing? Corporate profits? How does that feed into valuation and so on? And just a reminder that for the past several months, the estimate from Goldman Sachs has been that the year-end price target for the S&P 500 would be about 2850, based upon our above consensus view on corporate profits and so on. And before this correction began, let's assume it maintains its status as a correction, the S&P was at 2873. So we were there. And I would just remind your listeners that you need to have valuation support to be at sustained high levels, because if it's already priced for perfection, there can be any number of factors that will knock you off kilter. And I think that's what has happened. And there are a number of factors. Some of them may prove transitory. Some of them may have longer legs. And I think it's important to chat about them. So, for example, there are some people talking about the technical aspects of what happened over the last week or two.
Yeah.
The absence of share buybacks, for example, because corporations weren't able to step in and buy back their shares because of legal restrictions where they were in reporting season. The role of ETFs, the role of individual investors who may have panicked in to the market at the end of 2017 and then got a little skittish. I prefer, as you well know, Tom, to look at the intermediate and longer-term issues.
Mm-hmm.
And those, to me, there are some concerns. You know, when we get within this range of what we think fair value is, we really need to focus on what some of the catalysts might be, both positive and negative. And on the negative side, quite frankly, government policy coming out of Washington, to my eye, is not supportive of sustainable intermediate and long-term economic growth. Combination of changes in the tax policy, the new budget proposal, the infrastructure proposal, and recent changes in trade policy, these are not beneficial, in my view, for intermediate and long-term growth.
Jonathan here. Before we get into the long-term fundamentals, I do want to ask you a question about investor psychology. Mohammed Al-Erin and others asking this question after the volatility of last week, whether the conditioning of the last few years, buy the dip, get rewarded to buy the dip, has punctured dramatically and changed enough that we break out into a new regime where investors aren't conditioned, rewarded, just to buy the dip all the time. Has that shifted a little bit?
I don't deal directly with individual investors, so it would be presumptuous of me to make a judgment. But I would basically say that beginning in the summer of 2009, what was priced into the stock market, if you reverse engineered the valuation models, was basically at least 5 years of recession. What was baked in was at least 5 years of ongoing annual 10% declines in S&P earnings. What's priced in at $28.50, what's priced in at the prices we had a couple of weeks ago, would be several years of ongoing profit growth and no recession. So when you have an environment in which what's priced in is really ugly and what turns out to be is less ugly,
right,
share prices can rise.
I want to pin you down on this, Abby, because of time. Are you fully invested or have you increased an Abby Joseph Cohen cash position?
I never discuss, if you will, my personal portfolio, if that's what you're asking. If you're asking the Goldman Sachs position.
The Goldman Sachs poop, you know, your position.
Let me be very clear, and that is we remain concerned about fixed income. We think that bonds will be rising in yield, i.e. declining in price. And we see this not just in the United States, but around the world. And so for us to see what has happened over the last couple of weeks in which fixed income prices declined, and then equity investors said, wait, that's not good for equity valuation. That should not have been a surprise to anyone. I would also point out, interestingly, that the Goldman Sachs interest rate forecast that there would likely be 4 increases in short-term interest rates this year because we thought the economy would grow, wages would rise, inflation would rise. That
right.
is now become the consensus view.
Okay. But when we get to our next section, we want to talk bigger and broader, but I've got to ask you about the sudden change in our fiscal policy. Our last guest called it a Nixon goes to China moment. Do you see the new fiscal legislation of this nation as a Nixon goes to China moment?
I do not. Nixon goes to China, although I had not heard that expression before, was recognizing the reality of the growing importance of China, and Nixon coming from the Republican Party, along with Mr. Kissinger, who was very strong, obviously, in his views, could move forward on this. When I take a look at the changes in fiscal policy right now, I think that there is a high degree of, I'll call it, lack of responsibility.
Well, that was delicate as well. Who's going to be the adult in the room in Washington, Abby Joseph Cohen?
We're going to need many adults, and we're going to need them on from both parties.
Abby Joseph Cohen, Advisory Director at Goldman Sachs and Senior Investment Strategist.
Right now, folks, and this is a great joy to bring in a book I'm reading cover to cover. I will not mince words. It is likely to be my book of the summer. It is The Threat Matrix. It is 650 pages. It is thick, thick, thick. And joining us, Garrett Graff of The Remarkable Accomplishment, it is a page turner. Garrett Graff, wonderful to have you with us. How do you make a history of the Federal Bureau of Investigation that thick and a page turner at the same time? How did you go about writing The Threat Matrix?
Thanks for the kind words. So this book grew out of actually my fascination with Bob Mueller in the late 2000s, sort of long before he became a national figure, but sort of just as he was becoming the longest serving FBI director since J. Edgar Hoover himself. And I was just sort of fascinated by the extent to which the FBI under him had, in the years since 9/11, transformed from a domestic law enforcement agency into an international intelligence agency, and sort of what globalization and technology had done to change J. Edgar Hoover's FBI.
One of the great things about him, out of St. Paul's and with his work at Princeton and on, is a singular moment early in your book where the Marine, distinguished Marine out with true combat duty in Vietnam, his life changes in that warehouse in Lockerbie, Scotland. How did the special counsel change when he walked into where they were reconstructing that Pan Am plane in Lockerbie?
Oh, this is really one of the big turning points in Bob Mueller's career. You know, we sort of forget now just how long Bob Mueller has been involved in public service. I mean, he's spent almost 50 years of his life now working for the Department of Justice. and was in the early years of the George H.W. Bush administration, the head of the criminal division at the Justice Department. And so he was the person ultimately in charge of prosecuting the Pan Am 103 bombing and the investigation. And it was for him walking mm-hmm. into that warehouse, as you mentioned, in Lockerbie, where they were collecting the plane pieces from that terrible bombing, was a real turning point for him about sort of his search for justice in the world, and then also an up-close and personal moment about the power of international terrorism and sort of what a force that was. And most people don't realize right. that he has been intimately involved in that case ever since. And, you know, even shows up on December 21st every year for the memorial service at Arlington Cemetery.
Right. Garrett, you are ensconced in Vermont as far as you can from the madness of Washington. When you see the coverage of Mr. Mueller's affairs as special counsel with the president, with all the different players involved, just the beltway noise that we see, how do you respond? What is the thing that all of the media gets wrong about the gentleman that helped build the threat matrix?
Well, I think the thing that is most important to understand, or that I find sort of most fascinating about Bob Mueller, is just how clear his moral compass is, and sort of just how straight it is. I call him, America's straightest arrow. And, you know, sort of all of this partisan wrangling about him, you know, he is in Washington about as apolitical a figure as there possibly could be. I mean, he's held top jobs and been appointed to top jobs in all five of the last presidential administrations, Reagan, both Bushes, Clinton, and Obama. And his most recent appointment, a two-year extension, an unprecedented special act of Congress to extend him for 2 years as FBI director, passed the U.S. Senate 100-0.
Garrett, can you speak about the FBI and its attacks on cyber, cyber attacks, and what the FBI is doing and what kind of constraints it works under?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's come up, you know, obviously a lot in the context of special counsel. We're learning a lot more. The general public is learning a lot more about surveillance law than I think any of us ever anticipated. The FBI is about 10 years into taking cybercrime seriously. The Secret Service was really the leader on cybercrime in the early years of the 2000s after 9/11 sent the FBI focused on terrorism. But the FBI is now very deeply engaged in cybercrime, and both on the nation-state side. I mean, we've seen some fascinating prosecutions against Iranian hackers, Chinese hackers, Russian hackers, and then also some tremendous work by the FBI, the Secret Service, and actually HSI, the ICE Homeland Security Investigations Agency, against sort of global cybercrime, which, for a business audience is one of the fastest growing sectors in business, unfortunately. I mean, the Justice Department just this week announced the takedown of a $500 million cybercrime organization.
Garrett, your most recent book, I believe, Raven Rock.
Yep.
Can you just describe for people the essence of that book and why it might be so compelling today?
Yeah, this was a book that came out last year, Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die, that I had originally thought was going to be a real history book. And it's the story of the U.S. government's doomsday plans during the Cold War, sort of all of the strange things that would have happened during and after a nuclear attack, and the mountain bunkers and secret plans to suspend the Constitution, and other strange plans that the government came up with. But unfortunately, it has turned into a modern history, modern nonfiction, as we struggle with the North Korea threat and once again begin to try to remember what we're supposed to do in the event of an incoming nuclear attack. The modern version of the Bert the Turtle duck and cover drills from the 1950s and 1960s.
Garrett, we hope to speak to you over the coming months and quarters as Mr. Mueller's in the news with this and that investigation. How did you respond when the president tried to parse the difference between the FBI agents and FBI leadership? That doesn't ring true through your book, does it?
The FBI leadership is largely agents. It's people who have worked their way up through the ranks and came to the organization, you know, with that same dedication to public service and the pursuit of justice that motivates the rank and file agents as well. You know, I think sort of one of the shames of the attack on Andy McCabe, the now former deputy director.
Right.
You know, Andy McCabe was a career nonpartisan public servant, you know, someone who dedicated his life actually to all things of fighting Russian organized crime.
Let's leave it there. Garrett Graff, hope to speak to you again. I can't say enough, folks, about the threat matrix. Full disclosure, Bloomberg Surveillance Disclosure. It is a thick, thick, thick book, but boy, does it read like a wonderful page turner. Really can't say enough about it. I put it out on Twitter a couple times here and will do so again. Garrett Graff with the threat matrix. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.